Tune into KBOO every weekday at 7 p.m. for Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective with Davey D. Hard Knock Radio features in-depth interviews and profiles with community leaders, activists, hip-hop artists, and musicians, giving voice to community concerns and offering a unique forum to explore issues relevant to hip-hop community. That's every weekday at 7 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Yes, it is 11 a.m. on KBOO Portland. That child got it right. And coming right up, we are standing by for Disability Awareness. This is a monthly show about issues affecting people with disabilities. And the host is Grace Eagle Reed. She has a guest in the studio today. I'll let her tell you all about her guest. And then at 11:30, it's an Oregon Community Media publication. It's a collaboration between community radio and other independent media with host Aaron Yankee. On today's edition, we focus on marijuana issues that affect the state in our new era of legalization. So don't go away. Stay right here on your community radio. Oh, and thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not yet a KBOO member, become one. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate Today.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland Eye Care, a Southeast Portland optometrist providing eye exams, contact lenses, and medical eye care, as well as eyewear from independent designers. Portland Eye Care is located at 41st and Southeast Division Street in Portland and online at eyepdx.com.
Hi. Welcome to Disability Awareness. I'm Grace Eagle Reed, and my guest today is Pete. So, hello, Pete.
And hi, Grace. It's nice to see you again.
And the reason we're not mentioning last names is because Pete is identifying as an addict, and we're going to talk about something that's actually kind of a delicate subject, but it is a disability, and since this is Disability Awareness, I thought I'd take the next two shows and we'll talk about disability, the addiction, disability of addiction. A lot of people who become addicted don't know where to go, what to do, etc. So we want to make sure we get some information out there. So, Pete, why are you calling yourself an addict?
Well, for 10 years, I smoked a lot of weed. I usually go to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings because what brought me into recovery was an alcohol addiction that consumed the last couple, 3 years of my life before I got sober. But before that, I spent 10 years smoking good old Northwest weed.
Which is now legalized.
Hooray!
Coming up. Now, since it's legalized, is that a temptation for you to reach for it? Since, geez, I can just have some pot now.
I'd probably be a fool if I said it wasn't a temptation, but I wouldn't know where to get started. I'd probably go to a medical marijuana clinic and they'd say, no, dude, you need to go down the street a ways. I'd be tempted to jump the gun. I think July 1st, 2015 is when the new law takes effect. Yeah. But mainly, I'm just not interested in it anymore. I don't have the desire to do it. I know what the consequences will be if I do it. And it's just not fun anymore.
Wow, that sounds like a cure. Sorry, you're cured from it, huh?
No, I'm not cured. What I believe is I've just got a remission from, I'll speak in terms of alcoholism, the disease of alcoholism. I'm not so familiar with MA programs, Marijuana Anonymous or Narcotics Anonymous. The recovery that I have has happened in Alcoholics Anonymous, but the principles are still the same.
Well, you know, last show, I was talking out of how stress is a trigger for otherwise unexplained epidemics in public health. Mm-hmm. So, the Oregonian talked about war, racism, poverty, and we know poverty, a social justice issue, poverty drives all sorts of stress in the general population. But then, so when we're under stress, we do know that stress produces a seeking of not being stressed anymore. So for an addict, an instant fix seems to be the go-to, in my observation. And so since we're looking at addiction issues in an addict, and then I know my involvement with any of this was I worked as an addiction counselor for many years, so I came at it from that level. And one of the bigger researches that just came out, a recent research, it just came out after about 35, 40 years of looking at addicts, all sorts of different addicts. They talked about the addicted brain and the non-addicted brain. There's a lot of brain research going on with images, and it's amazing because it just, you can't say, well, no, marijuana does not, I can't get addicted to marijuana, because in fact the brain images say otherwise. They looked at hardcore drug users, different kinds of drugs, marijuana use, of course, alcoholism, and they looked at how this impacts the brain, and it literally puts the common nomenclature is holes in the brain, but it literally is holes in the brain. It tends to eat the brain up on many levels, especially over long term. The good news is that once an addict is off of the stuff, given time, then the brain tends to heal and rewire. So they're looking at one of the things I pulled off the web is, why can't addicts just quit? You know?
Why can't addicts just quit? Well, I'm a total amateur at this brain research thing. All I know is what I've read in anecdotal studies or, for example, Men's Health magazine, that when you do a certain behavior, if you're doing it for 2 or 3 weeks, it becomes an established pattern, a habit, and then it becomes easier and easier and easier to do that particular thing or engage in that behavior. And I know that when I got sober in 2009, it was about 2 or 3 weeks before that urge to do that same behavior again, pick up the bottle or pick up the joint, started to leave me. And I don't know if this is the case with other people who do this, because I've heard other stories in Alcoholics Anonymous of people who are 1 or 2 or 3 years sober who still feel that obsession to pick up. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how to explain that. I'm glad that wasn't my case. I mean, being self-centered, I'm glad that wasn't my case. So I don't know what else to say about that, except once I started practicing the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, it took about the same amount of time for it to become established. So now my train is going in a certain direction,
yeah,
doing certain things to improve my self-health, my self-awareness, that it's hard for me to stop doing those things. It would take another 2 or 3 weeks for me to stop doing those things before I would be able to not do them anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so that makes me want to say that in my opinion, I have 36 years of recovery, and I wrote a book about it, and it's on negotiatingshadows.com if you want to, and it was published in Oxford, England. But I wrote a book on the power of Alcoholics Anonymous and the power of the addict, or giving the addict a choice to at least use those programs, they're called 12-step programs, to at least get started, if nothing else. There doesn't seem to be anything present in medicine, in regular chemical medicine, that can help or allow the addict to stop drinking or drugging, except an abuse, and then people drink on that. I've heard those stories because, again, as an addiction counselor, I heard stories coming from the addict to me as a counselor. And then for me, I've also I have long-term sobriety recovery, which is incredible. And the newest research is because addiction changes the brain circuits. So when I saw this the other day, I went, ah, because when I was counseling, I worked for Fairbanks Native Association for many years as a counselor and in Alaska. And after treatment and after people were done with their program and their treatment and everything like that, the only answer we had once they were released to prevent a relapse, because in fact relapse is automatic if something else isn't in place, and since people can't stay in treatment forever, you know, mm-hmm. and usually people that go out after treatment will in fact automatically relapse. So I went, aha. And the thing that we recommended as counselors was you go to meetings. It seems like the only go-to. The court system is now also mandating people to come to meetings. So I'm thinking Alcoholics Anonymous is, in fact, from my observation and research, one of the most powerful forces to possibly change the brain circuits. And I think that's possibly what's going on there. What do you think?
I agree, Grace. And by meetings, you mean Alcoholics Anonymous uh-huh. meetings. Yeah.
And NA or whatever you're right. familiar with.
Right. What I'm about to say doesn't, I don't know if brain researchers are able to identify where in the brain the will is, the human will, the will to do this, the will to do that. But the theory that I pick up in reading AA and listening to people's stories there is that this very will that I want to use to try to stop drinking or to stop drugging has already been hijacked by that particular drug. That drug, my will just wants to engage in that behavior. It just wants to smoke weed or just wants to drink. And so I'm trying to use that sort of damaged will to pull itself away from that substance that it's become so inured to, it just won't work. So my story is back in 1996, I had developed a habit of drinking every day for about a year. And it was just two beers a day, but I felt like I had to have those two beers a day. Mm-hmm. And I tried a couple of times to go 30 days without drinking. I couldn't do it. I eventually talked to a friend who I knew was an Alcoholics Anonymous who said, if you want to know if you're an alcoholic, try to quit for 30 days. And I couldn't do it. And I told him so. So eventually I somehow mustered up the willpower to not drink. And then I didn't drink again for about 10 years, but I didn't go to any kind of meetings. I didn't fill up my life, as you said, with some other kind of program to help me with life. I just kind of white-knuckled it, if you will, throughout that. And then in 2006, 2007, when I started drinking again, it wasn't at two beers a day. It was at 8 or 9 or 10 beers a day. And somewhere in there, the line had been crossed where I could effectively exercise my willpower against two beers a day, but not against 8, 9, or 10 beers a day. I was sunk.
And I know that when I researched AA, they talked about the inability to control your drinking and that it will progress even when you're not drinking. And therein does lie some mystery that the scientists are trying to figure out. But until then, and they talked about the control issues being very low, the drive being very high, the memory of that either loss of memory of that what crashed and burned you to the memory of all the past stuff that drove you to drink in the first place. It's amazing.
Are you talking about, in memory, are you talking about, even though I had a miserable time drinking the night before, I get up the next day and I somehow
forgot,
don't remember that.
Had no memory of it.
That's not going to influence my behavior that day. I'll just do the same thing over again.
Right, yeah. So it's so hardwired.
That's pitiful.
Yeah, and well, thank God you found something that's helping you.
Yeah.
I know I promote AA and NA, the program, all the time, of course. In the Willamette Week, on 2/11/15, volume 4115, in the cultural section, There's an article called Chronic Problems. Marijuana addicts from around the world will gather in Portland this weekend. Here's one man's harrowing tale of pot addiction. And he goes by the name of Paul G. And he says, my famous, and this was in 2011, this was February. But I found this, I had gotten this, and I found it, and I went, oh, this ties in with the program today. And it says, Paul G. says of this, my favorite description of being a marijuana addict is that it's like getting your ass kicked by a Girl Scout, I'm quoting Paul. It really seems like it shouldn't happen, that it can't happen, and yet it keeps happening. You feel bad or anxious or depressed or bored, so you get high. After a brief yahoo, you feel all that bad stuff even more because you're inhaling a powerful depressant. And I know alcohol is also a depressant. So here we are going in depressed and then adding something that creates more depression. That's, wow. So it's powerful stuff. It's a killer disease. By the way, this is disability awareness, but we don't talk enough about the disability of addiction, and it's killing a lot of people as we speak. And I'm particularly interested in the elders out there that may not know if you're drinking and you can't control your drinking, it probably would at least be a good idea to maybe go check out an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting nearby. They're all over the place. Perhaps Pete could clue us in on where some of them are. But I wanted to finish this last paragraph. Please, plus, now you don't even want to go outside, much less you know do anything. So now you feel anxious again and reach for the pipe again. It's an excellent recipe for shame and despair. That looping that he talks about, and actually he's got quite a long article here. So that's Paul G's testimony on this thing. And he said a lot of people don't think that you can get addicted to weed, but he said, wrong, you can absolutely get addicted to weed if you're an addict. What about the people that aren't addicted?
I don't know. You should have one of those persons on your show.
I know.
I just got addicted to it. I loved weed. I loved everything about weed. I loved putting the paraphernalia together. I loved scoring it. I loved scraping the resin out of the bottom of the pipe when I didn't have any weed left and smoke that. And then when that's all done, then I get anxious. Then I've got to go out and get my next fix. But it's like any other behavior that we talked about where the brain gets rewired to expect that behavior. I just 6 weeks ago quit a Skittles addiction. I was in the habit of having my dinner, sitting down at 8:30 to watch another episode of The Good Wife and eat a cup of Skittles.
Wow.
And I didn't think I could get out of that habit. It took a few days to get out of that habit. It's just any kind of behavior that you groove a pathway for and you associate it with something. I mean, anything that's associated with The Good Wife is going to be enjoyable, isn't it?
And we, according to again, the research that I've seen is we are, the alcoholics say of themselves, we are bodily and mentally different from our fellows. So I think that's what you're referring to. Like a social drinker probably would not do that. I have social drinker friends around me and I have addict friends such as yourself around me. And by the way, the other person that is not an addict that wanted to come on couldn't make it. So I did have somebody else, but she couldn't make it. So that's okay. My non-addicted friends can take half a beer even. I've seen them even take a half a beer and set the rest down and go, oh, I've got a little buzz going on.
I don't know what's in their minds. I couldn't do that. I mean, my whole life was centered on drinking, and if I wasn't drinking, it was how to get something to drink. When I woke up in the morning, that's all I thought about. Mm-hmm. And whenever anything like that is at the center of your life, mm-hmm. and it's not a good thing, mm-hmm. Other people are going to suffer. You're going to suffer. That's what's so crazy about alcoholism. It doesn't just affect the person who has it. It affects that person's family circle. Yeah. It affects that person's social circle.
Yeah.
So in that regard, it's an insidious disease.
which is why we're talking about it. So are you a bum off the street? Did I just go out and get you off the street and you're some kind of bum and you're living under a bridge or?
Yeah, I'm living under the Burnside Bridge in a condo. No, I'm just kidding about that. No, it didn't get that far for me. I have a bachelor's degree, a master's degree, a law degree, and where my addiction really took hold was my first couple of years in law practice. I went to law school late in life, graduated at 45, and I smoked pot all through law school. I became the top student in the school smoking pot every day, and so I thought I could do anything. Mm-hmm. And so I went into law practice thinking I could keep smoking pot every day. I would wake and bake, I'd get off the max, toke up out of my one hitter, go to work, a couple hours later, wander off from my office and go to a parking garage and toke up some more every couple 3 hours. And my work product declined. Mm-hmm. It's hard to practice law. It's hard to do a lot of things that require concentration if you're high all the time. Mm-hmm. But I just loved being high. Mm-hmm. So no, I'm not a bum off the street. I'm a, mm-hmm. I don't know, middle class, upper middle class guy that had a problem. I don't think alcoholism or drug addiction discriminates. If you're going to do the behavior and you have something inside you that will receive, I don't know, they talk about the genetic basis. I don't know. I haven't seen any of the research. I don't pay any attention to it. I just work the program of Alcoholics Anonymous because it seems to work for me. My life has gotten incredibly better than it was when I was drinking. And I didn't drink my entire life. I spent maybe 5 years total drinking and maybe 2 years drinking alcoholically. But I was not self-aware until I started working the Alcoholics Anonymous program.
What is that program? How does it work?
How it works. Want me to recite it from memory? How it works. Really? Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path, that kind of thing. Yeah, it consists of doing certain things that draw attention away from yourself and put it on others. The nearest I can get to it is that there's a spiritual component to it that involves a higher power of whatever you want to choose. In my case, I'm a traditional Christian, so I have the Christian Trinity as my higher power. Mm-hmm. And whether you believe that there is a higher power or not, it's, to me, the idea involves a mental trick that if you can stop focusing on yourself for a few seconds and focus on either another person, pray for another person, talk to that person, listen, whatever it is, to pull attention away from yourself is good, because when I get miserable, it's all I'm doing is I'm thinking about myself and thinking about my misery, and talk about a negative feedback cycle. I start worrying about the future when the future doesn't even exist. I mean, the only thing that there is right now. So the future doesn't exist. The past is done with. And whenever I'm not present in the moment, I'm telling you, I rarely have those times when I'm really present in the moment. Mm-hmm. But the precepts and the principle of Alcoholics Anonymous helped me to stay out of thinking about myself constantly and try to think about others.
I often go to a site called The Fix, which is kind of a modern site for people who are interested in addicts and all things addicts and anti-addicts, and there's a lot on there bashing AANA. It doesn't work. It's a cult. It's a religious thing. It's a da-da-da. What is your comment on something like that? Is it a religion? Is it a cult? Is it a scary place to show up and you'll be sucked into something, or...?
Alcoholics Anonymous, when people get together in meetings, it functions just like any other group would function. There are people there who have got the same problem you have or are pursuing the same goal. This is why people associate and why they've associated for eons, is that they want to band together in order to pursue some common purpose or to share some common problem that they have. And I've never been in a group like Alcoholics Anonymous, we're so specific about the one problem that we have, that is, we have an addiction to alcohol. I haven't found the same sort of solidarity in the church, as good as it may be. It does not focus on the problem that Alcoholics Anonymous does. And when I first started going to AA, it seemed weird because they were talking a bunch of different technical terms, but you know, that's all it is. They're just technical terms. We talk about the fourth step or the 11th step or the ninth step or whatever. Mm-hmm. You just learn the technical terms and you eventually become familiar with it and you start meeting people and you start growing connections between you and other people, and that's how a fellowship happens.
In other words, it's back to the circuitry, changing brain circuitry. If the researchers were to look at this, that's probably how they would identify.
Good point. You're talking about changing the social circuitry.
Social circuitry, yeah, mm-hmm. It seems like. And I know there are 12 steps. It's called the 12-step program. And I think most people are familiar with it. It's not that anonymous, but there is a tradition to stay anonymous if you are... you know, so that's why we're not mentioning your last name to honor the tradition. How old is Alcoholics Anonymous?
You're asking me to do math? I went to law school because I couldn't do math. But what, it started in 1935 or thereabouts? So what is that?
35, yeah.
80? I'm going to guess 80?
About 80 years old, yeah. So it's been, and I know it's all over the world. And all of the sister programs, there's all this NA and Cocaine A and Dis A and That A and the other A and Gambling Anonymous. And, you know, it just... The 12 steps program started a whole lot of movements mm-hmm. that, as you pointed out, specifically address that particular issue or problem or addiction, it's a phenomenal movement. It looks like it's a phenomenal movement. So do you have to be Christian or religious or what about atheists? What about people that don't believe in a God or any of that? What do they do?
I've heard a number of stories of people who came into AA who had no belief in God or were agnostic. They just didn't know whether God existed or not or whether it even mattered to mm-hmm. them. But I think it goes back to that bit about the mental trick that I said, whether you objectively believe that there is a God doesn't seem to matter because it's just I don't want to say this disparagingly, but it's just a tool to get your mind off yourself. You're tricking yourself to get your mind off yourself. I believe mm-hmm. there's a God, but mm-hmm. there are also groups of atheists, Alcoholics Anonymous. Mm-hmm. I don't know how they do it, but
they stay
God
sober.
Bless them. Ha ha.
And they stay sober.
Yes, they do.
Yeah, many years. Yeah, I've got friends that are atheists that are in a program and are staying sober. A day at a time. So 12 steps, I know there's the, seems like the 1, 2, 3, again, as an addiction counselor, I came at it looking at that. And I was able to look at the steps as there seems to be an issue with power, sanity, and then the higher power. Mm-hmm. And those three steps seem to set people up to at least address their powerlessness with the substance abuse. And then the sanity issues, well, yeah, you are insane if you're drinking and driving and whatever. I've heard all sorts of stories, needless to say. Suicide, big suicide problem, people turn. Again, it goes back, you know, the original statement here was stress produces a way to get out of stress. And so today's show... with Pete is this. He chose to get out of his stress by picking up drinking, drugging, and it didn't work. And he is an addict, and he's at the mic today to encourage anybody that thinks they're an addict to do what?
You look up on the interwebs, Portland Area Intergroup. That'll be the main website for Portland's AA groups, NAMA. And then you can select a weekday or a different search method to find a group near you, or you can simply call the hotline. I'm sorry, I don't have that number, but
yeah,
on the internet, so you can find
it. It's on the internet. And if anybody wants to know more about the show and any of the research I've done and the book that I've written about this, it's negotiatingshadows.com. And I'm Grace E. Eagle Reed. And my phone, actually, which is a message machine, you have to leave a message 503-224-0843 if you're interested in any more information. And I can also connect you with any of the helping agencies that if you think you're an addict and you need some help and you want to try out the 12-step programs. Okay. Thanks, Pete, so much for coming on. I really appreciate you coming on and being my guest today.
Thanks for having me, Grace.
How I'd love to wander back.
Hi there, this is Rita Christie, host of the Noontime Jamboree on the first and third Monday of each month. Please join me for vintage jazz, country, and western swing. That's on the Noontime Jamboree, the first and third Mondays from noon until 2 p.m. right here on KBOO.
Fifth partnership show of Oregon Community Media, independent community radio and media working in collaboration to better serve Oregon. This time around, you'll hear about marijuana issues that affect the state in our new era of legalization.